probably some of the mysteries of Berkeley that I'm done.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so this is the recorder. I'll just move it here. Okay. Yeah, just ignore it.
All right.
And I usually just start, this is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. I'm with Tyga Bell on his boat, the Triad, on June 26, 2019. So I'll just start, could you restate your name for me?
My name's Tyga Bell.
And tell me a little bit about where you were born.
All right, I was born in Fairbanks, Alaska, 1981, May 21st, 1981. And I think when I was a month old, I first came out to the Hobbit Hole with my folks.
What did your parents do? What do they do?
So they're commercial fishermen, and we fish for salmon, trolling hooks through the water, and we pull each fish aboard by hand and clean them and ice them and sell them for money. And then we also fish for halibut by laying hooks out along the bottom of the ocean and then pulling them back in after a few tides. And that's just the way I grew up on my parents' fishing boats. We didn't have a house in the summer when we come out here to Southeast Alaska for 5 months a year. And when we were a kid, we just slept up in the bow of my parents' fishing boat at the Hobbit Hole. And it was a pretty unique and cool way to grow up.
And were you aware that it was a unique childhood at the time?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. We would go back to Fairbanks, which is a town in central Alaska with 100,000 people. And I went to elementary through high school up there, and I guess a little bit at UAF. And being around all the kids even Fairbanks is real remote and small compared to a city in the lower 48, but it gave me a real sense that out here was different, you know, and the middle of nowhere. So I always knew. And then my parents would take us traveling in the winters because they work seasonally. So they'd take us out of school for the third quarter of school, 2.5 months, and we would travel to third world countries and all over the world and Africa. And that was real eye-opening too on a different level. But the Hobbit Hole was a really cool place to get to spend my summers, and there was a few kids around. I was the first or the oldest kid, and then there was my brother, and the Stromies had Eric and Katie, and then Dennis and Peggy's kids, Annie and the twins, Alice and Rosemary, were pretty much the only kids over at the Hobbit Hole. And I was always excited when we got over here to Elfin Cove because there's a few more kids running around. My buddy Cal, who we ended up buying his house down here. It was kind of me and my brother Ryland's way to get off the fishing boat, was to go hang at Cal's house. Because at the Hobbit Hole, we didn't own the Hobbit Hole. It was Greg and Fred, who are kind of my godfather, Greg and... And Greg wasn't my dad, so I wasn't going to hang out at the Hobbit Hole for the day while my parents were fishing. We went with them fishing every day, pretty much. And as a young man, I got seasick, so horribly seasick.
Really?
So often, you know. And
did it gradually happen, or?
It gradually went away. Mm. But I think it was... When I remember as a young kid, on my parents' boats were smaller then. They had, they kind of worked their way up into nice fiberglass boats from little wooden skiffs, pretty much. But we would be on the boat, and most of the time we're fine, but sometimes it get a bit rough and get seasick. But it definitely was a kind of a mental thing. And as I got older and got my own boat, it's gone away, and I'll still get a little queasy when it's, 20-foot seas for 18 hours or something. But that was a fun part of growing up and being on the boat all the time. But when we got to the Hobbit Hole or Elfin Cove, we just get off the boat and run around, and there's endless wilderness. Hike up to the lake at the top of the mountain, or out to Magic Beach and catch dollies. And
what are dollies?
Dolly Varden are, I guess they're a trout. It's a lot like the salmon. And they eat the salmon fry, so the little baby salmon are their food. And they're just a nice little, you know, maybe 2-3 pound little ocean-going trout.
Can you still catch them now?
Yeah, I catch them for fun sometimes, and my kids now, my boy's 5, and we go and catch them. He caught one the other day right over here, it's fun. There's a lot of fish around here that if you just know where to put your hooks, you can catch all kinds of fish around here. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely been a part of my childhood growing up here. Is we would go at the Hobbit Hole down at the point. There are these tide pools that when we have tides that range up to 12 feet. So when the tide goes out, the beach is just uncovered and there's all these tide pools, and we just look under rocks and flip over rocks and pools and find all these little fish and eels. And, you know, it was a really cool thing growing up to go tide pooling and just, you know, exploring and learning about all these cool little creatures that live right there. And when I was a little kid, I have some early memories of just being at the house at the Hobbit Hole. We would do maybe 10 boats that would anchor up throughout the summer, and that number would change. Sometimes there'd be a party and there'd be 20 boats there, and that would be a captain and a crew on each boat. So there'd be, you know, 40 people. And
they're just fishermen?
And they were just fishermen that would, and, you know, Greg was really hospitable and generous, and just, you know, and the core group of the hobbits or the people that lived there would hire a cook gardener for the summer, and that person would maintain all the gardens, which really were thriving when I was a kid. And there's a giant strawberry patch that I just raided daily, huge strawberry patch. And the cook would keep all the gardens in order and harvest lots of good greens and food out of them, and also make a dinner. And all the fishermen would go out and fish for the day, and then meet up for dinner at the big house there. And we'd all have these little wicker plates with paper plate in them, wicker with a paper plate. And you'd have a nice dinner together and do it all again, you know.
Do you remember what you ate?
There's a lot of fish and rice and salad, you know, was definitely a staple. But there are tons of pastas and lots of good desserts and stuff. I always remember a strawberry rhubarb crisp and pies. And, you know, Greg's mom, Doris, made an amazing chocolate cake with a little bit of peppermint in it or something like that. I think it was a peppermint chocolate frosting or mint frosting, but she made it was kind of like a fudge cake that was really a special one. And my mom makes really great apple pies and strawberry rhubarb pies, and so we'd always have it was always good food, you know, lots of fresh fish, because we're catching, you know, 5 different species of salmon. There's lots of rockfish, ling cod, black cod, halibut. You know, they're just the ocean here is really really full of life. And there was a crab pot in the middle of the hobbit hole. And about once a week is all you could eat crab. Oh. And then over when Dennis started shrimping in Idaho Inlet, we, you know, every few times a summer or every few weeks or whatever, he'd show up with literally 5 gallon buckets full of shrimp. And you'd just sit down with these, everyone sitting down in the sunshine, you know, and cooking up shrimp and having a good old time. The sea otters have been kind of, their population has been blooming around here and have knocked out the crab population, so you can't catch crab there anymore, but there's still some shrimp around and some secret spots. there would be, we had freezers with meat in them, and there's a lot of deer hunting around here, so there was a lot of time some sort of canned deer or deer stew or, you know, big lasagnas. But generally the food was very good and very healthy, you know. People would make, you know, that rice fish salad combo is pretty standard around here, especially if you can get a fresh king salmon. Mm-hmm. It's hard to beat.
So for how many generations has your family been fishing?
My parents are from Indiana, my dad, and my mom's from New Jersey. And back in the 60s and early 70s, they were traveling around looking for adventure and made their way to Alaska and made their way, you know, out here to Elfin Cove fishing, basically. And that's where they met each other. So they were the first generation. And then now there's me and my brother each have fishing boats, and I take my son Ronan and daughter Kira out with me, and they're already learning to pull the fish aboard the boat. I'm not, you know, locking him into being a fisherman, because it's a pretty tough way to make your living, but it's a possibility for him. So, you know.
Do you remember, like, what is the earliest memory you have of fishing? Do you remember, like, the first fish you caught, or?
Well, I remember that, I'm not sure how old I would have been, but 5 or 3 or something, my mom used to have a boat called the Cashon, and it was probably a 22-foot wood skiff with an outboard motor, and she had to drag this foam ball behind the boat to slow it down, to go slow enough, and I can definitely remember that big float back behind the boat, and the kind of, you know, it was a different time, and they just were, they didn't need much, so they had just these crappy little wooden boats, and we were living in this space that's probably, you know, 6 feet by 6 feet and then my dad had his boat, the Man of Erin, which was a 26-foot wood boat, and then my dad bought the Gunvor, which would have been a 30-footer or something, a little nicer, more seaworthy wood boat. And then I bet you I was around 10 when my mom bought the it was called the Penny Joy then, her boat, and then named it the Madam Ching. And we've had that for 35 years or something, 30 years, I'm 38, so. And then my dad bought the Village Idiot, and those are the two boats that they have now, the Village Idiot and the Madam Ching. And they've caught a lot of fish on them. You know, they've been doing it a long time. I bought a boat when I was 25, the Lori, old wooden boat. And then just recently I decided to go for the big time with this big fiberglass freezer boat.
I guess because I don't know much about boats, but, like, what is the difference between having a wooden boat and a fiberglass?
Well, one of the main differences is the price. So, a fiberglass boat will just, they require less maintenance. That's one of the main things. Is a wooden boat, every year, if you want to take good care of it, you have to sand all the paint off and repaint the whole boat, and then you put it on a grid, which is a place that will, you let the water go out, and the boat is out of the water. You can paint the bottom of the boat as well, which is important because we have, they're called Doritos, these worms that will eat the wood.
They're called Doritos?
Yeah, Doritos, like the chips, I guess. But there's a couple kinds of worms. That's one of the names of them. But yeah, they'll eat holes in your boat, basically, if you don't put this copper paint over the hull to protect it. But yeah, I guess back to my first memories of fishing. I mean, it was when I was real young. My dad had his own boat and my mom had her own boat, and me and my brother would go out with my mom every day. And I mean, just look around at how much is going on in here. That's a radar, and mm-hmm. that's a GPS system, and that's a fathometer, and we got radios, and you got this, I mean, all these different switches here control another part of the boat. So there's a lot going on. And then you have wind, tide, you know, what the currents are doing to the boat, other boats around, and it's just a lot to pay attention to. So it was really pretty amazing that my mom was raising two kids while fishing the boat by herself. And so I just remember from a very young age, I think I was probably 5 years old when my mom like started having me using a knife and cleaning the fish, pulling the guts and the gills out of them. And I was moving fish, and as soon as I was able to pull the fish aboard, I was pulling fish aboard and working. And so was my brother. And then as we got older, we replaced the crewman, or the hand on the boat, and we were the deckhands. And having grown up doing it, we were good at it. You know, anything that you grow up and spend a lot of time with, you get better and better at. And so when I did finally get my own boat, you know, without even realizing that I had this huge advantage of growing up fishing my whole life, there's all these little lessons that I'd learned, and it's been very advantageous for me to have grown up in it and know how to do it. You know, now that I have my own boat, it kind of just right from the get-go, I was catching fish and doing well. So I owe that to growing up on a fishing boat.
Did you ever want to do anything besides fishing?
Yeah. I went to college in Fairbanks for kind of leaning towards doing architecture. Mm-hmm. I'm an artist. I carve wood and make puzzles out of wood, and I have a little shop in our house in Juneau where I work on stuff like that. And I pretty much anything art, I like painting, and I just didn't foresee that being a real money maker, and the fishing kind of fell in my lap. And it was when I first bought my boat, I thought, okay, I'm gonna do this for 5 years and get some money to pursue my dreams. And by 5 years, I loved it too much to quit. You know, it's there's a lot of freedom in a job where you can just go out to the outside coast and go fishing wherever you want and get paid for it. You know, it's pretty awesome. So, but we do push ourselves to work long hours and stuff to actually make enough money to make it, you know, to survive at doing it. It's not a the fishing that we do is kind of small time. We're not getting real rich out here, but it's an awesome lifestyle.
So Deborah's saying that like Greg was sort of the like top fisherman in the area, and she was mentioning how like when people like your generation started like almost replacing the previous generation of fishermen. I don't know if you noticed that yourself, but
Yeah, I think that that's just going to be a constant thing, because there's always a kind of a hungry young guy who's going to come out and have that drive. And, you know, even now, like in the last few years, I kind of had my time where I was the top dog for a while, and my brother's like been catching more fish than me, and then there's guys from other places that are just phenomenal fishermen, and it's all a bunch of luck anyway, and it's just, if you're able to stay out for, you know, 16, 18 hours a day, those hours add up, and a lot of it's just a numbers game of how many hours you can keep awake and fish, and that's how many fish you can catch, you know. But there's a lot of local knowledge and just knowledge that comes from experience. So, yeah, as far as there being a best fisherman or a best anything, it's all about a big gray area, and there's always going to be, you know, a generation that is just taking it easier and easier, and maybe a new generation that's coming up hot to trot with a bunch of energy, ready to you know, do things a whole different way. And the technology around fishing here has changed immensely since I was a kid, and especially in the generation before that. You know, when my parents came out here in the 70s, their boat wouldn't have looked anything like that. They would have had a machine. This right here, I'll turn it on real quick, is a fathometer. So it's a color machine that will tell you how much water there is beneath the boat before you hit land. And right now it's 1 fathom, so 6 feet is underneath the boat because it's low tide. So what they had was just a little circle with a little flashing light, and the light said, you know, oh, it's somewhere between, and right now we're in such shallow water that this doesn't really apply as much, but say you're fishing in 20 fathoms, they just had a light that would blink somewhere around 20 fathoms. So their machine was probably accurate to 60 feet or something like that, whereas this is accurate. It's a color picture that's accurate to 0.5 feet or maybe even to inches.
How much is 1 fathom?
1 fathom, 6 feet. So 120 feet would be 20 fathoms. And a lot of times you're fishing in 120 or 180 feet. Sometimes we'll go as deep as 300 feet down for salmon, for king salmon. But the technology is just so vastly different. And the generation before them had, they take a can, like a lead, and they dip it in Crisco, and then they put it on the line, and they'd run it down, and they have these knots every 6 feet, and then they count the knots. They're like, all right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay, we're at, you know, 120 feet or whatever. And then that Crisco on the lead would pick up something off the bottom, like rocks, gravel, you know, is it sand, is it, and then they get an idea. And that's how they did all the surveys around here, you know, originally was with a lead and a line, and they'd get that sample and say, oh, it's rock down there, or it's sand down there, and they'd write a little thing, sand and 180 feet or 1,000 feet or wherever they're going out here, and they made all the original maps, you know.
Why is it important charts to know if it's sand or rock?
Well, it's not so important. It can help for halibut fishing. More important is to know where the reef is, because our lines are hanging down in the water, and you want your lines to come close to the reef because that's where the fish are feeding. But if you hit, you can rip off your lines, lose your leads, bust up the reef. You know, that's you lose a line of fishing gear, and it's $500 or something. So it's a big deal, and you don't want to. You really want to know where you're at. But what I'm saying is that the previous generation, and especially the generation before that, were using a completely different set of skills to find where these reefs were. They're using something called line of sights, where you'd take a rock and line it up with a tree in the distance, and when those two lined up, you could turn right. And then you'd go to the right for a little bit. And then when this rock lined up with this other rock, it's time to turn left. And you're finding these, you know, kind of intricate courses through the rocks by line of sights. And nowadays you have a GPS program that has got you within a foot of exact. And my computer has a bathymetric program that makes a three-dimensional map of the bottom that is updated by your fathometer wherever you go. So wherever I go out there, I'm creating a actual 3D map, because the maps you buy, the charts are not perfectly accurate. So the technology just is vastly different, and it's definitely pretty helpful. And then the invention of cell phones is the thing that just spiked the whole fishing, you know, around here to another level. Is, you know, when they used to talk on the radio and have these codes, you know, oh, I'm eating that tuna fish sandwich over here, and his friend's like, oh man, he has 100 king salmon, I'm going over there, you know, and it was all on the radio, everyone could hear it on the radio. But once you get a cell phone, you just call your friend and you don't have to code anymore. No one's listening to your cell phone, though there were some guys who bought cell phone de-scramblers and were listening to everyone's cell phone conversations. It's pretty messed up. But yeah, so we just use cell phones to code now and call each other in on the bites. And every year, the fishermen are getting better and better at finding the fish and helping each other find the fish. And cell phones are a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Bringing us snacks.
Oh, are these lentil turmeric crackers?
There's some sort of something like that, if you think so. They might be yams.
I've had these crackers before. I love them.
Cool. These are kind of cool. These are killer whale teeth that I found on the beach out near the hot springs.
Teeth?
From a killer whale.
Wow.
I haven't found any of the bones, so I think it was like really old. The bones have all been ground up, but the teeth are harder, so they, for whatever reason, just have survived on the beach. And I've gone back to that beach and looked again and again, and I found 5 teeth.
Whoa.
But,
interesting. It's just the teeth by themselves.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of interesting. That's why I think that they're pretty old, you know. And then this is a Japanese glass ball. They are from pre-plastic. So back in the day, they had these guys who would blow glass floats, and this would float a gill net along, and they'd have a line of these floats, these glass balls. And now they use plastic floats because it's, you know, cheaper and easier. But those glass balls have been floating around the Pacific sometimes for 30 years, and then you find one, you know, or 50 years or 100 years, and you just find one floating around, and oh man, it's a glass ball. It's like a treasure around here.
Wow. And you're just thinking, like, who must have used it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What they were
and
doing.
Yeah, there was a tsunami in Japan a few years ago, and 2 years later we had all kinds of plastic floats and sandals and just bits of plastic and floating things and glass balls that showed up around here, kind of a wave of trash that had been rinsed in by that tsunami. So the current rinses things from Japan to Alaska, and for whatever, at that cycle it was 2 years that it took to get there. But some of these balls and things are floating around out in the ocean, and just the chance that you would have one wash up on a beach and not shatter on the rocks, you know, it's like such a treasure to find one. And sometimes we find them just floating still, you know, they haven't made a landfall yet.
So even now, you live here, or you're here in the summer, then do you go somewhere else in the winter?
Yeah, so we live here for 6 months from May until usually the end of October. And then we take off to what we've been doing the last 6 or 7 years is going for 2.5 months to Indonesia. Yeah, I go surfing down there. Yep, we're in here.
So we. These rails look so shiny.
Oh, thanks.
Don't they?
Yeah.
They just look wet.
But yeah, we spend 2.5 months in Indonesia surfing. And then we go to Juneau. And we're doing a little interview in here.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, just chilling.
Yeah.
Awesome. I saw you brought some bedding up to the house. I was going to see if you wanted any of those sheets washed.
I don't know that they need to be
like
washed.
Your downstairs sheets, they're fine.
I think that, these other ones?
Just any of them for your season, you know? Just didn't know if any of the bedding downstairs needed a wash or, because I'd be happy to do a quick load of sheets if you need any done.
Yeah, that's a good thought. I'll check it out. I guess I'll give them a sniff.
They're probably fine.
I think so. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I put new bedding on this.
All right.
I haven't really slept down here much.
I know. I just don't know. Sometimes
folks have me and Shane
that musty smell.
We'll figure it out.
Well, today's such a nice day. I actually am out of like spare laundry to do. We caught up with all our laundry.
Oh.
It's like these beautiful days. I love hanging stuff out and drying, like, you know, letting it dry in the sun rather than always drying it in the dryer. So I'm thinking, gosh, if I had a load, I'd do it, but you're good?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks.
Cool.
That cardboard box is going up to the shop in the house.
Uh-huh.
Could bring it up partway or something.
Nice. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for stopping
this
in.
Cardboard box?
Yeah, is it heavy? Don't bring it if it is.
I'll just bring.
Yeah, those go up in our room in the house. Just bring those flashers. That's fine, honey. I'll get it.
Hey, cutie. See you later.
Mm-hmm. So what were we talking about?
Surfing in Indonesia.
Oh, yeah. Going surfing in Indonesia. So, like I said, in growing up, we would spend, I think it was around 5 months at the Hobbit Hole, and then we go back to Fairbanks and go into school, and for the third quarter, so around Christmas, when we'd have a big Christmas party at our house, and then we'd take off with my family and travel to really cool spots. We went, Indonesia was, when I was young, was really a place that I liked. All the beaches down there, my parents were into scuba diving. We went to Nepal a few times, hiked up to the base of Mount Everest, and went to Africa quite a few times. And so when I got out of high school, I started traveling my winters, and I went to Australia and New Zealand and back to Indonesia and to Thailand and Mexico, and I've actually been to every country in Central America and,
wow,
and South America. I've been to a few, and then I got into surfing out here from some local kids from Haines whose parents had bought a fishing lodge in Elfin Cove when we were probably in high school, and they were just a little older than me, really cool guys, and we all hit it off, and they took me surfing for the first time out in Cross Sound here, and it was really fun. I liked it, and through my traveling, I started to go to these cool surf breaks. Raglan in New Zealand was one of the longest in the world, and I stayed there. I rented a house for a few months and was surfing every day and just got way into it. And then my travels became more about surfing than adventure, and I just try and find, you know, I went to surfing down the coast of Mexico and across the coast of Brazil and down across New Zealand, and And Hawaii is amazing for surfing. We did a winter on the north shore of Oahu, and the waves were just huge. It was awesome. But we found this little town in Indonesia that is really quiet. We can get on our motorbike, and there's kind of endless deserted beaches. And, you know, it's a paradise. And there's 7 world-class surf breaks right there. And the kids can go swimming in hot water on the beach. I mean, the water's, seawater temperature is 80 or something, you know. We've been spending 2 or 3 months for the last 6 of the last 7 years in the same town in Indonesia. And my kids have grown up with the little Indonesian kids down there. So they have a bunch of friends when we come back. And then at the end of that, we come back to Juneau, and we have a house in North Douglas that's right by the ski area. So I'm way into snowboarding. And so the fishing thing is cool because I work for 6 months, but then I get 6 months off to surf and snowboard.
And so are you living off the money that you made over the summer?
Yeah. And in the past I did construction work in Fairbanks in the winters and with some traveling, but it kind of got me to where I can live off of my earnings for the summer through the winter, and supporting the family. Amy doesn't work, and it's been a great lifestyle.
Did Amy grow up in Alaska as well?
No, she's from Michigan. And her parents split up, and her mom was down in southern Texas for a while. So she grew up her summers up in Michigan and going to school on the border of Mexico and Texas for a while. And then her mom moved back to Madison, Wisconsin. And we've gone and visited grandma down there a few times. Mm-hmm. It's a cool town, beautiful area.
But did you two meet in Alaska?
We did. We met in Juneau. The first time we ever met, we just kind of saw each other at a music festival, the Alaska Folk Fest. And that was really cool. And then a few years later, we ended up getting together. And I drug her out here to the boondocks, and I think it's been a pretty good fit. It's not just any woman you can get to come out and live with you and rough it, you know. And though we're living a pretty comfortable life,
I mean, last time I was here, Deborah was showing us the backyard, and I was just thinking, to be a kid and to grow up in a place like this, it's absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at the Hobble Hole, we just kind of had free range, and the yards were kind of bigger. The trees weren't so overgrown, so there was more sunlight, and it's a big area, big playground kind of, and there was a volleyball court, and the fishermen had a little more time. It seems like they were taking a little time off to all relax and have a party now and then in the sun and have a volleyball game. And then the crew were these young guys who, you know, from 18 to 30, 25. And they, not every year, you wouldn't always get a new crew. Sometimes a guy would last for 3 or 4 years or 6 or 8 years and then get a boat and become one of the captains. But there was always an influx of new people. And as a kid, that was always, you know, trying to find someone to play with me. You know, let's do this, let's do that. And they're all tired from working all day long and just trying to relax. But there was always, you know, somebody, because there was a pool table, and I think I remember still being there, 7 years old, and winning at pool for the first time, beating a crewman, and I'm like, all right, you know, I'm getting good at this. So I got to be a pretty good pool player, and there's a dartboard. There was always a dartboard and a pool table. So I would try and get, you know, games going all the time. Croquet, whatever I could get going. Soccer, anything. Frisbee. There was a lot of dogs running around, too. The Oli was Greg's dog that was around the same age as me. So when I was growing up, I was like probably 3 when he was a little puppy or something like that. So we grew up together. Mm-hmm. And he was an incredibly smart black lab golden retriever. And you could say, like, Oli, give me my slippers. And he'd go get you your slippers. He'd say, Oli, there's a mink on the dock. And you start freaking out. And you open the door. He'd run down to the dock and check for the mink. And, or, Oli, there's a deer. And he'd start looking around. Or, there's a bear. And he's just, you know, sit, stay. And he was, anything you asked, he was doing it. You know, and they'd take him hunting, and he could be quiet, and he was just a really well-trained, good dog. And then there were some other dogs there too that weren't quite as bright, but they were cool. And I remember we had this long walkway out to the dock, and it's different than it is now. It was just 2 logs with 2 boards, with 4x4s kind of holding it together. But you just had these 2 planks to walk on, and those dogs would just come, 3 big golden retrievers would come barreling through and knock me in the water a lot. It seems like a lot, you know, like more than once a year I would go swimming, you know. And my dad built a little rowboat called the Cat's Paw out of plywood. And so, did you ever see the book that my mom wrote? She wrote a little children's book called Work Is Around Me.
I didn't know your mom wrote a book.
Yeah, from the perspective of me when I was 7 years old with my brother things that we did out here. So, yeah.
But it's called Orcas?
Orcas Around Me.
Huh.
So, yeah, you might want
to. We need to get a copy of that.
You should get a copy of it, yeah. And it's totally right up in the theme of this oral history, because it's just true stories of things that happened when I was a kid. You know, these killer whales came, or my parents hit a rock with their boat, and then these killer whales came and like rubbed against the sides of the boat and were kind of surrounding our boat, and then they went off. That was one of the Orcas Around Me part of the story. But yeah, we had this little rowboat, and we'd just cruise around, and, you know, my brother's 4 years younger, so I was always taking care of him, and we'd just go off and get our life jackets on and cruise and row around and catch fish. I had all these, like, the beaches are covered with, like, when you're a kid, everything's a little treasure, you know. There were shells and little dried crabs and feathers and rocks and stuff. So I would always have these collections of treasures that I would be, you know, we'd walk to Magic Beach and I'd come back with a pocket full of these super cool, you know. And then I had, what did I call it, like secret places or something. And I would take all my treasures and hide them in these certain stash spots. And I don't know, you know, where I got the idea, but I had around the Hobbit Hole, you know, these secret places where I'd hide these cool treasures. And I had like a little, I don't know, almost like a little shrine or something of little cool treasures laid out behind this tree up by the hot tub, you know, or whatever. And I remember some of the adults were like, what is that over there? You know, that's my secret spot where I hide all my treasures. It's interesting to be from a place where there's not a lot of other kids, and you don't have a lot of, like, it's almost like normalization when you get put into a school classroom and all the kids' minds kind of get mashed together into what's normal and the more normal you are is kind of how you can be understood and understand other people, you know. And being from a place that's super unique, you get your own perspective. And I've always, like, wanted to have that uniqueness, but also have that kind of line of normalness to where you still can could get into a group of kids and know how to play all the games and know, you know, and that was cool. Going back to Fairbanks in the winters where we went to, you know, there was 400 kids in my graduating class or whatever. It was a decent sized school where there was, I still got a bit of the unique solo, you know, hobbit hole time, but then a little bit of, you know, just getting, you know, run through the system and like everybody else, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like what were some ways that you, or like how did you sort of normalize yourself to the people when you were in those situations?
I don't know. I don't know if I was communicating that very well, but I just am saying that that it's. I definitely got a unique experience at the Hobbit Hole, being like one of the only kids there and having to come up with your own games, and you create kind of your own world in a way, and then to go and meet up with some other friends from Fairbanks and tell them about that. My friends heard about the Hobbit Hole, but I didn't like go into too much depth about it to my good friends because they couldn't really relate, because it's a, you know, up in Fairbanks, it's all like flat rolling hills, beautiful forests, but there's no ocean. There's no, you know, this secluded paradise. And so that was like a different part of my life, and I wouldn't take it with me so much when I went back to Fairbanks. I would just be Fairbanks Taiga and roll with all my homies there, you know, and then I'd come back to Elfin Cove and I'd just be me and my brother again and maybe a few other kids it's interesting now that I have kids to think about them growing up out here and how to give them, you know, everything, give them the freedom and that feeling of just being a kid in paradise wilderness with wild strawberries and blueberries to eat, and you're catching fish in tide pools and with a fishing pole and camping out and cooking them up right there on the beach and stuff. But also, you know, making it to where they can go into Berkeley or someplace and not be totally blown away because it's so different than the place that they grew up, you know. And it's been a cool thing about, I guess, my upbringing was that I got a bit of all of it, you know. I've been to Tokyo and Mexico City and LA and New York and I've spent a lot of time out here.
Do you consider this place your home, though?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. This is the place that just feels like home, and when I'm coming here and leaving here, it like wrenches on my heartstrings. You know, it's a really. I also consider our house in Fairbanks, which we sold and I haven't been back to for 20 years, my home. But this is definitely, for me, the home now. And I think we moved from the Hobbit Hole when I was 14 or so. So the Hobbit Hole I consider my home too. But this Elfin Cove house is starting to be as well. Having my young family and everything here, it's becoming like the most solid home of all. But it's interesting just going back to the Hobbit Hole and seeing the change, and it's great to see so many young people excited about making it awesome. So that's what I like about it.
But do you ever miss sort of the days with Fred and Greg and all those people. And
For sure. I think that they all kind of think of some of those as their, you know, they all, Greg and Fred and my parents and Stromy and Dennis and Ron and all the crew that was out there all probably think of that as the golden years when they were, you know, at their prime and living a really healthy, you know, fun life together and definitely it's like this gained camaraderie, gained emotional connection between all the people and the place, you know. So there's definitely just a lot of good memories from fun things that everybody did together there and some volleyball games. There was this one time, it must have been 4th of July, and Greg had a wooden barrel completely full of bottle rockets to the top.
What are bottle rockets?
Bottle rockets are fireworks that just, you know, and there's like literally 1,000 bottle rockets. And 25 people, probably 30 people, and we started this bottle rocket war, and there's the creek coming down the middle of the hobbit hole, and I was maybe 10 years old, just in heaven. Oh my God, this is the coolest thing that's ever happened. We, you know, give me 10 packs of 12 bottle rockets and I'm gonna go. You know, no, there was probably like, they were talking 10,000 bottle rockets, and just all out war ensues, and it's the 4th of July party, and there's, I'm sure they were drinking and doing whatever they did and shooting these bottle rockets everywhere, and finally there was this kid Spencer, and he caught one behind the ear and it burned his neck and blew up, and that ended the bottle rocket war. But it was just this crazy, you had your some sort of PVC pipe or a bottle or something that you were using as a gun to shoot these bottle rockets, and sparks are flying everywhere, and we were trying to hit each other. It was all about trying to hit each other. When somebody actually got hurt, I was like, oh no. But way fun, giant bonfires, you know, and they had like talent shows and music and just shenanigans. There was always practical jokes going on between the different captains, and some of the, you know, they're just a bunch of hippies, and I'm not sure who orchestrated it, but it was this guy Pat Vischer. I'm sure my dad will probably tell you the same story, but he was going to bed, and it's like 11:30, and you tie outside of Greg, and Greg gets up in the morning, you don't care, he's gonna cut you loose, he's going fishing. So if you tie outside Greg, you know that you're gonna have to wake up super early, 3:30 a.m. and get gone. And he went to bed, and they set his clock forward, and the twilight of night looks like the twilight of the morning, and then his crew came down, Greg's coming down, we gotta go, and he woke up, and he started untying the lines, and started up the boat, and taking off, and he looks up, and there are a dozen people on the dock laughing at him as he pulls out, and he figures it out that it's only 11 at night, and he'd been sleeping for 15 minutes, you know. But yeah, my brother and his friend Nelson and their buddy Edgar, they you know what splicing is with a rope, a three-strand rope. Mm-hmm. You can take it apart and you make a loop and then you weave it back through itself, and it's a pretty involved process, and you end up with this beautiful loop that's spliced back into the line. Mm-hmm. And one time we were had a bonfire, we're drinking beer. My brother and Nelson and Edgar went down to me and my friend Patrick's boats and spliced all of our lines to the dock. And they took the buoys and they put them through the bull rail of the dock, not blocking the boat, but through the dock, and spliced them as well So the boats, we woke up in the morning at 3-4 in the morning to go fishing, and just were kind of bewildered, like, our lines are spliced to the dock. Like, it's not something you can untie, you know, you're going to have to cut your lines. And it's just, it was a, I thought, a really clever practical joke, you know, and kind of a classy F you. and the practical jokes are just kept, you know, it's been going on forever in the fishing fleet. You tie something up in the top of someone's mast, and like a rubber chicken or something, they're going, it's up there for a week before they see it, and what the heck.
Did you ever orchestrate any?
Yeah, I mean, we had tried to get them back for the spliced lines, and we ended up, Nelson left, and we took every piece of line in his boat and tied it like a giant spider web to the dock. And then we had kept like beer cans for months. Like it would have been like 4 or 5 big black garbage bags, like beer cans, and we covered his whole boat in beer cans. And oh man, I remember our buddy Zane. Somebody got like the cover of a gay porno and put it up in his window, but behind some books, so he couldn't see it. But anybody else who went by his boat would see in his window. This, and yeah, it's just funny stuff people do. But yeah, it was one, that cool thing that I was talking about is the influx of new crewmen every year to the Hobbit Hole was really. There was the boys club, and it, and for a while I think they hung out up in the top of the warehouse, was basically the boys club, and the pool table was in the studio for a while, and then they moved it up there, and it was just, you know, a bunch of young guys who didn't have much prospects or whatever, just were like, well, I guess I'll go fishing in Alaska and make a few bucks hopefully. And you'd get a really, you know, diverse crew of people from the East Coast and West Coast or wherever, and a bunch of Texans. And as a kid, it was always, you know, they were all older, and I was always like, thought they were so cool, you know, and just learning from people from all over. Mostly what they were doing is taking bong rips and smoking, you know, smoking and playing pool and drinking. But there was also lots of, you just learn things from people through listening to them. I just, that was a really cool thing for me growing up, was to have, you know, 200 older brothers, you know, over the course. I remember pissing somebody off and getting drugged down and thrown in the bay because they'd had enough, you know. I'd stolen their hat or sprayed them with the hose or done, you know, I was always looking for attention and somebody to play with, so.
Yeah, even now, that's one of the things I've really loved about living there. It's just with all these student groups coming in, you meet so many people that I would probably never meet otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And like everyone just has something that they can teach you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
So when you're away fishing, how do you still stay in contact with your family here?
Yeah. I mean, we talk on the phone, basically. We try and plan everything pretty strategically so that I'm maximizing my time with my fishing hooks in the water. Mm-hmm. So I'll come in. We start the season, and then I come in either the 12th or the 14th, and then Ronan's birthday's on July 24th, and I make it in for that. That'll be the second time that I restock the boat. And then, you know, once you get to the end of August and the last 20 days of the season are in September, and I'll be fishing closer to home usually then, and It just all depends. We just really focus on making money while we're fishing so that we can take the rest of the year off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we sacrifice the... Amy's taking care of the kids, and they're having a lot of fun. We just got this new skiff. Our old one was getting too old. And
this one on the right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Amy's able to take that out to George Island with the kids, and they can camp out there. And there's a beach right up that way. It's called Strawberry Beach, and it's strawberries from, you know, twice as long as all this, or three times as long, and all you can eat strawberries, you know, wild strawberries. They'll be coming out in the next few weeks. And, you know, at the Hobbit Hole, there's strawberries around the Hobbit Hole, and also at Magic Beach, which is around through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And the next beach is called Eagle Crest Beach, and there's a few strawberries there too. But a lot of the beaches around here have wild strawberries on them, out of Cape Spencer, over the glacier at Brady, up in Idaho Inlet, and Althorpe, and Dundas. And then there's wild blueberries all around, all the muskegs, and the salmon berries are coming out.
Morgan's telling me she's going to make me go pick berries once the season starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, if you go down from the house down the bay of the Hobbit Hole, down the right side, before you get to the far end is the super salmonberry patch, and I've pointed it out to Coulter. But that's where you can go and just fill a 5-gallon bucket with salmonberries.
So the house is here along this side?
If you're at the house looking at the water of the bay, you go around the right side. And when you get down towards the far end on the right side, that's the salmonberry patch down there, the best.
That's where Morgan lost her glasses a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We were picking the salmonberries and she got so excited, and I guess they just slipped off her head.
Oh, no. Yeah, so you guys know the patch. Yeah. Good. Cool, and they're starting to go ripe?
Yeah, they're just starting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So have you noticed any differences in, like, the fish populations just over the years?
Yeah. You know, it's, the fish, the salmon are, the numbers are maintained by, fishing game. And so all the streams around southeast have fish counters in them, counting how many salmon make it into the streams. And so then they set up our quotas, which is a number of how many we're allowed to catch based on how many are making it back to the streams. So the salmon is something that they can get a really clear idea of how many are surviving and how many are making it back to reproduce and how many are coming out as babies. And they have just massive amounts of scientific data, and they are, you know, regulating the salmon by that. And then they have what's called a hatcheries, which is different than a fish farm. There's salmon farms some places, which are pretty bad for the environment because of all the excrement from the fish, kind of poisons the water system, because they're not free ranging enough. But a hatchery releases the fry, kind of it's almost like an artificial river. So they release all these fry out of the hatchery. They go out and they live out their 3 to 5 years in the wild, and then they come back to that same hatchery, and they have special fishery, like they'll hire a fishing boat to catch a bunch of them to pay for the whole thing. And the hatcheries have definitely helped the salmon numbers, but generally, I don't know whether it's technology is a little better. We've had some of the best fishing we've ever had in the last few years. 2013, 2014 were some of the biggest years of all time.
In terms of the quantity of fish?
Yeah, the amount of fish that are being caught in the allotted time, and just the amount of fish that are out there, and it changes every year because salmon are on a 4-year cycle where they go out to the ocean and they come back to the river, and you never know from one year to the next whether you know, there was a drought or something, and so not as many made it up the streams, and that next 4 years later, the fishing's bad, you know. So there's a lot of factors. And the salmon are probably the best regulated because of the fact that we can count them so well coming up and out, in and out of the streams. The halibut and black cod are really big money fisheries. And the bycatch, which is all the fish that are not halibut and black cod that are caught when you're targeting those species, is kind of a problem. It has been a problem for fishing game and for everybody for a long time, is that you catch all sorts of things that are not halibut, and you try to unhook them gently and let them go, and they usually survive. But there's just, as far as watching the fish numbers change, there's just a lot of factors, and there used to be a run of pink salmon and chum salmon out at Three Hill right here that isn't around anymore in the numbers it used to be. And whether that is due to the seiners, which is a big net fishery, these huge boats scoop up like a big call it a purse seine, you wrap this net around the school and then pull the purse and the whole thing comes aboard. And I think that what happened a few 15 years back, there was a big drought and all the salmon were sitting out in front of the streams waiting for it to rain, and the seiners were let to just scoop them up. And so I think they hurt some stocks pretty bad, and a few instances like that happened, and I'm not just blaming it on the seiners, but there's a lot of factors in the change that the fish are doing. One of the things that we notice is the Brady Glacier is producing more runoff than it used to because of global warming. And so there's all this silty glacier water coming out, more than there used to be. And in the last 5-10 years, it started to make it all the way across the mouth, across sound. And the fish, even though it's only, you know, 10 feet deep or a foot deep, they don't like to feed with that cold, silty water for some reason. So they'll congregate and kind of school up outside of the sound where they used to school up in the sound. And the best I can tell is that it's due to this glacier water, more glacier water than there used to be. And that's affecting their feeding patterns a lot. And again, maybe global warming, or just that there's more, you know, more runoff from the glaciers because it's warmer. Yeah. The mountains out here used to be just white, and now in the summers they are no longer white. They're a lot of rock exposed, and there's still some hanging glaciers, but it used to be solid hanging glaciers when I was a kid. So there's been a lot of glacial melting, you know, and that's something that's really affected the way the fish are feeding in the area, which is affects what we know about their numbers. You know, we just know by how much we're catching. But yeah, it's generally the fish numbers are probably going down a little bit, and technology's just keep making it seem like there's just as many because we're catching as many or more. I hate to think that we're catching too many, but it's hard to think that we're not, because that's kind of a human nature thing where the whole world has wiped out the fish from all these fishing grounds all over, and this is such an incredibly rich fishing ground that maybe we don't see all the damage we're doing, but we're definitely, you know, try and be aware of what impact we're having, and it's just good to see that we're, you know, having these great years and big returns, and there still are a lot of fish around, you know, but I definitely worry, like, for Rona's generation, are these fish all going to still be here? And I think my parents thought the same thing when they first showed up, you know. So But a specific, you know, decline of a certain species, I don't know that I've noticed. There's definitely areas that have been, you know, that used to be better and that people have overfished and that aren't as good. And there's quite a lot of charter outfits here that have been kind of operating without too much regulation of how much they're supposed to take home and stuff. So there's a lot of fishes. They could fish the same little pinnacle day in and day out, and that pinnacle is not going to have as many fish on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So but as far as like the us wiping out the salmon, it's not happening, as far as I can tell, you know. But there are, like I said, the pink salmon run that was out here is not out here, and it's either due to some overfishing or some climate change thing where they're feeding in a different area.
So your parents are still fishing?
Yeah, they are. They call themselves semi-retired.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, is there a retirement age or?
No, I don't know. I'm trying to think of who was a really old fisherman that is still doing it, because it's pretty hard on your body as you get older. Will start to shut down, and it's hard to maintain the ability to pull these heavy fish aboard, and it's physical, you know. So, but they will definitely have trouble selling those boats, because it's a lot of their identity, you know. It's when your whole life you're a fisherman, and then you sell your fishing boat, and you know, are you still a fisherman or what are you, you know? So they're trying to find that transition, and I think what'll happen is they'll sell dad's boat first and both work on mom's boat, because that's what we fish halibut on. It's under 36 feet, so it qualifies for the kind of pounds that we have for halibut fishing. And they're just figuring that transition out, you know. And we had the gardens at the Hobbit Hole, I guess, but now we have our own place with gardens to work on.
You're doing really well too.
Buying this place with my folks was a great thing for them, to get them off the boats. That was a lot of my motivation, was just thinking of them getting older, and for years they wake up and then they turn the key and they go fishing, and they got ahead financially where they didn't have to go fishing anymore, but they were still going. And so we got them, we went halves on this property, and they got their little house. They wake up in their bed and they make a cup of coffee instead of turning on the boat and going fishing. And you know, if they decide that they want to go, then they go. But they're definitely just having more fun. And my dad has the speedboat to cruise around and go to the hot springs.
Oh, yeah, that was fun to ride in today.
Mm-hmm, cool. Yeah, yeah, it's great. It's a great boat for going to you know, further destinations like Hoonah or the hot springs out past Pelican or Gustavus or the Hobbit Hole or something, whereas the little boat's just for real close to town and, you know.
But they still love fishing even after doing it.
Yeah, you'll have to ask them that. Yeah. You know, I'd say my dad is pretty done. but they definitely love it, you know. They wouldn't have made... It's a thing that you do it for a few years and then you're kind of locked in to just keep going, and you develop a lifestyle around fishing that it's hard to say no to, and it's hard to get out of. Like a lot of jobs, you know, where you, as a fisherman, you don't need a college degree, you don't need to have any, you know, specific schooling or knowledge. You just have to buy a permit and a boat and figure it out. And I think a lot of people who get into the fishing lifestyle, then go like, well, what else would I be able to do? What sort of job could I get where I'm making this kind of money? And the answer is not much, you know, in the same amount of time without any specific skill set or education. So, and I mean, I think both my parents have a college education, but they just, and they have skills to where they could get a different job, but yeah, they love the freedom of it, I think, as I do. So,
how do you name boats, by the way? I'm just seeing all these Village Idiot, Nanching, Triad.
Sure. Well, the Triad is the name that this boat had. Dad's boat was called the Harold L, and Mom's boat was the Penny Joy, and they didn't like those names. So, I think that the pink, my dad was mainly a pink salmon fisherman, and Mom, they also were targeting silvers, but the price dropped to 11 cents or 6 cents 1 year for a pound, which is, you know, now it would be 30 cents or something, so 5 times less, and I think that's when my dad named his boat the Village Idiot, because he felt like a dummy, you know, out here catching all these fish for so little and working so hard for so little. And it was funny, Village Idiot. he was kicking around the name the Artful Dodger after the pickpocket from Great Expectations. And then the Madam Ching was a pirate who took over her husband's pirate organization when he died, and was like a infamous tycoon pirate lady. Yeah. So that's where those names came from, and there's lots of superstition in fishing. So they say it's bad luck to change the name of a boat, but these guys have had lots of good luck, so who knows. But
I mean, you just kept the name of your boat
so far. Yeah, I don't have any, and my old boat was named Lori, after one of the Viking gods, and I kept that name too. I liked it. And
Lori, what is Lori?
Lori is Loki's brother, apparently. Lory. And Loki is the trickster, you know, and they're twin brothers, and Loki's not as well known, or Lori's not as well known, but he's basically like, they're, him and Loki steal Odin's eye and all these pranks and things. They're kind of the bad guys, but it's a good name for a troller, because when we're dragging our hooks around, we're always kind of stealing from each other by getting in front of someone. You're catching the fish right out from under them, and it's, you know, you always have, if you get in front of me and start catching my fish, I'm gonna cut in front of you next time and steal your fish, you know. So there's this little etiquette thing that's always going on. You don't cut people off. It's a lot like in surfing, how you just respect the other people and they respect you, and you're not hogging all the waves, and you're not fishing hogging all the fish. And there's definitely people who are very aggro and crazy, and you know, a lot of reputations of people, you don't want to piss that guy off, you know, he's gonna, my brother got shot at a couple years ago, as he was
really?
With a guy pulled out a pistol and started shooting at him. It's just like, and he didn't hit the boat, so there was no evidence. The police couldn't do anything. They came out here, but it was just, I think it was a meth head guy, a fisherman. Mm. It was just, there's a lot of crazies out here, and because it's kind of the end of the road, you know, and especially back when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, and I think before that, it was more of the Wild West out here, and there was, you know, confrontations with guns and heavier stuff going on, and lots of whiskey and cocaine and who knows, among certain circles of the fishing fleet, you know, there's not just every fisherman's not the same at all. But there's a pretty rough crowd back then, I think. You know, people would, you have these float bags that hang out behind your boat, and I've heard of people pulling out a shotgun and blowing someone's float bags away just because they were cutting too close to them, you know, fishing. And there's something to it. If someone's, you know, stealing $100 out of your wallet, you might be upset, or $1,000, you know. And essentially by pulling your boat in front of somebody when they're catching a lot of fish and catching all the fish right out from under them, it's stealing money out of their wallet, you know. So there can be, tensions can get high out there. Mm-hmm. And especially some of the other fisheries, the herring seining and things, where you have this $1 million boat and hundreds of $1,000 permit, and you're allowed to fish for 24 hours, and you either make, you know, literally millions of dollars, or you lose money depending on who catches the fish. And there's planes flying over that these guys are going, okay, I see it over here, and there's people listening on the radios and everything to try and figure out where these herring are and scoop them up, and boats will purposely ram each other, these 80-foot, you know, giant, oh, you know, 60-foot boats, and there are some pretty competitive fishing, you know, especially the seiners and the gillnetters, because it's a bigger money thing than the trolling, which is...
Which have you do?
This is called trolling. So these big poles go out, and we just have lines that are going down to leads and clipping on little, we call them spreads, a line with a hook on it. So we can drag anywhere from 20 hooks to 120 hooks at a time. And it's considered more of a gentleman fishery, where we're not quite as cutthroat, and you just are putting in lots of time and taking care of every fish individually. On here, I'll catch a fish, and then I have a little heading spot where I head the fish, take the head off, and that releases the blood, and it starts to the most important thing is to get the blood out of the meat. And you,
why?
Because that's the first thing that will rot, is the blood. So the fish will stay fresh longer. And so then you hook it up to a little pipette bleeding system that goes into the main vein in the neck, and flush water through the whole circulatory system and clean every drop of blood out of the fish. And then you'll take the gills and the guts out and scrape everything out. We have this little brush at the end that you just clean up to where there's not a single drop of blood in or on the fish anywhere.
And that's for every single fish?
And for every fish, yes. And then you dip it into a garbage can that has water and just a dot, just a drop of Clorox in there, just to help kill any extra bacteria or anything before we freeze them. But the fish that we're producing on this boat is the highest quality salmon in the world that you can get, because of that process of it being caught ocean bright before they ever touch fresh water. The fish will start to rot as it touches fresh water. It'll start to die before it gets to the stream and spawns. It'll start, their body will start to break down and change. The salmon go from a beautiful silver, purple, blue color, and then they start to turn kind of like army green or red, or as they hit fresh water. And so we're catching them ocean bright. We're bleeding all the blood out of them. You know, we have a gaff hook, which is a bat with a hook, and we hit them on the head in the water, and that stuns them. So they come aboard and they're not flopping around or anything. They're dead, and they're usually dead with the first hit, and you don't get a bruise. You know, every fish is just handled, you know, painstakingly by hand to be as perfect as it could ever be, you know. And that's the cool thing about trolling, catching them with a hook in the mouth, and taking really good care of each fish is kind of our thing. It's because it's the highest quality. Whereas if you had a big net and you just scoop up a huge bunch of them, they kind of mash together and the net's pulling their scales off, and and just the weight of all of them pressing and smushing, and then they catch so many that they send them to the factory, to the cold storage to be cleaned and processed there, you know. Yeah. And so that extra time and that extra pressure and stuff is, it's kind of a subtle thing, but it's not as quality of a fish as what we're producing on the trollers.
So where does your fish go once you sell it?
Well, I sell to a guy down in Sitka usually, and he's sending it, a lot of it overseas. I think when I was a kid, a lot of it went to Japan. And now a lot of it's going to Europe as well, and more to the States. And it kind of depends. There's a bunch of different fish buyers, and I think some of them, the one in Juneau Glacier, I think has a lot of domestic markets, so stuff down in the lower 48. But there's not enough people in Alaska to eat all the fish that Alaska produces, you know. They're just 500,000 people in all of Alaska. So you need to get it from this remote location to the cities, basically, and to be able to sell the, you know, I'm catching 40, 50,000 pounds of fish, and I can't just go and sell them at the Elfin Cove market, you know. Yeah. There's not enough people. So I sell to a middleman, and then that guy makes a healthy amount of money off of my fish, getting them down to those markets in the States, and a lot of them are going, like I said, to Europe and Japan and just anywhere that they can find a market. And the world's so interconnected now that it's a click away. You know, they had a website, and you look up Dryad Fisheries and can read all about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And actually, the guy I sell to, the guy who used to own this boat, Bruce Gore, started a company called Triad Fisheries, which is now the fish buying company that I sell to, was started around this boat.
Oh.
Kind of cool. But another guy's running it, and the idea behind getting into freezing, just being getting a better price for my fish, catching the same amount but making more money.
How much can you usually get for like a pound or like a catch?
Yeah, so
if you're comfortable.
Yeah, so like if you're doing the fresh price last year was $2 a pound, I think, for cohos. So a regular coho, say 5 pounds, so you get $10 for a nice silver, but the frozen price was $4.20, so it's more like $20 for a single fish. And we're trying to get maybe 100 in a day is a good day. There's times when you'll catch 500 in a day, pretty hard work. And there's days when you catch nothing pretty much, but if I fill the boat, I'll get 10,000 pounds and sell them for $4+ a pound, so $40,000 to bring the boat in full. Pretty awesome.
10,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all fits here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all down in that holding tank, that the whole back deck back there. And if it's if I was freezing with ice, I can fit 30,000 pounds. The frozen fish actually take up a lot more room because of all the fins and things that are frozen in place. They don't stack as nicely as the soft fish with ice.
You say you get more for frozen?
Yes. And it's because it's frozen at sea. So it's frozen within a half an hour of it being caught, which makes it just the best quality you could ever have. Whereas a lot of times the fisherman will be out for 3 days, then the tender gets the fish, and by the time it gets to the factory or the fish processing plant, it's already 5 days old or even a week old. And then by the time it gets to the grocery store, it's a week old or 9 days old or whatever. And then if it doesn't get sold fresh, then they freeze it. And it's just a huge difference to have a half an hour old fish frozen to a week old fish frozen. And that's So the stuff that I'm producing on this boat is, you know, for the finest sushi restaurants and the like, the really high-end restaurants would be the ones that would know the difference between a frozen at sea and a frozen at dock or something like that. And it's pretty subtle, really. Any salmon that you get from around here will blow your mind, you know?
Yeah, when I was here last week, Deborah had just smoked some, I think it was sockeye or something, mm-hmm. but it was the best, not even fish, but like thing probably that I've ever eaten. Blew my mind.
Yeah, sweet.
So good.
Yeah, no, it is. We're really lucky to have this bounty of fish around here and have my parents that know just what to do with it, you know. And through trial and error, they found lots of good recipes.
Yeah, I know we've covered a lot, but before we end, is there anything else that you want to talk about? Or?
The history of the Hobbit Hole from when it was a native village into a fox farm in the 30s, and then in the 60s the house bought it, and then there was a pack of fishermen living out there for the summers, and I was just a kid running around the place and given a pretty unique and cool childhood through being part of it. And I'm really happy to have been a part of such a cool, unique place. And I'm really glad that I can just go back and hang out, you know, still.
And I've been thinking, like, you've traveled the world, you've been to so many places, and yet you still come back here.
Yeah, oh, big time. This is home. And it's an amazing place. I mean, you can travel the whole world, and this is one of the most spectacular places you'll ever find, you know, this southeast Alaska with the rugged, glacially carved fjords and, you know, 16,000 foot mountains coming right out of the ocean, and wildlife everywhere, whales, and, you know, we just saw a pod of killer whales and humpback whales. There's a minke whale out front and doll porpoise and Pacific whiteside dolphin and harbor porpoise and sea otters and sea lions everywhere. And you know, you spend enough time here and you get these magic moments when two pods of killer whales meet up and they all start jumping out of the water, or you find a dead giant squid floating. You know, we had an 11 footer that we drug up on the dock of the Hobbit Hole one time. You catch, you know, been fishing for 40 years and you catch some fish that you're like, whoa, I've never seen one of those before. What is that, you know? And the longer that I've been here, just the more cool stuff I see and the more in love with it all I am.
Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Yeah.
This is really great talking with you.
Yeah.